You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you all here for today's special event. I was going to say values are important, but in a way I don't need to say that because this is a fantastic turnout for a lunchtime event, a Monday lunchtime event. So clearly, a lot of you attracted to a conversation about values. We're delighted to be doing this event in combination with the World Values Day and the Forward Institute. And we've got a great panel here to talk about the issue of values, the importance of values, the challenge of talking about values. It seems like values are a hot topic in society right now, and certainly most people and most organisations are eager to claim that they have values at the heart of what they do. But how much time do we actually spend thinking about our values? How do they shape us? How can we embed them into our work? How can they be salient at critical moments of decision-making? I didn't say I'm not going to make any substantive contributions to the debate. I'm just chairing it. But some of you may know that I'm undertaking a piece of work for the government, a review of modern employment. It became very clear to me early on in that piece of work that it only really made sense, or if I wanted to have any impact, I had to assert the importance of the principle of good work for everybody. Unless there was a commitment, a value-based commitment to the idea that everybody should have work that was, as I put it, fair and decent with scope for development and fulfilment, then the recommendations didn't really make much sense. So that was an insight for me, I guess, because I hadn't been involved in practical policymaking for some time, of the way in which values can become very important in a sense in making a lot of other stuff make any sense at all. We at the RSA support World Values Day because it gives us an opportunity to talk about values, but particularly because we want to engage a whole number of fellows of organisations and communities in this conversation, and I'll say something at the end about how we're hoping to take this work forward leading up to World Values Day in October. Anyway, we've got a great bunch of people to help us talk about values and to discuss the values gap. That's something I'm particularly interested in, the gap between what we assert and what we actually do when the rubber hits the road. So I will introduce them one at a time, I think, so that you don't forget who they are when they actually speak. We're going to start with a former colleague of mine, Jonathan Rosen, who's the co-founder and director of Perspectiva, a think tank dedicated to affecting holistic society. Is this your phrase, holistic societal change?
No,
not mine. Okay. But you've got to live up to it.
Yeah.
Okay. So please welcome Jonathan Rosen.
Thank you. So thanks very much, Matthew. It's lovely to be back here. So values, we could say almost anything about values, and that's part of the challenge, of course, is how do you give it some sort of analytical traction or visceral sort of feeling so that you leave today feeling we've actually said something. And that made me think that in this context, much of the values that we're interested in are the values at work. And that got me thinking of Guy Claxton, who said to me once upon a time, when I was talking about organizational purpose and how do you define organizational purpose? How do you get those values that drive the organization onwards? And he said, the trouble with organizational purpose is that organizations don't have stomachs. And he said that, and I thought, what on earth are you talking about? Organizations don't have stomachs. And what he was getting at was that there's a disjunct between values as this very abstract, textual, propositional thing that you write down, and the kind of visceral feeling you have when something makes sense or is meaningful or is moving. And there's a huge gap. So part of the gap we're talking about is not just a gap between intention and action, but a gap between two very different kinds of things. Which gives rise to the question, if values are not in your stomach, where exactly are they? You know, we always speak, what are they? And how, you know, which values are we talking about? But another question to ask is, where are they? Because if you think about it, we don't really see them in the world as such. We see behaviors, we have feelings, we see facial expressions and so forth. But values typically only appear in these wonderful things called value statements, which, you know, it's almost as if value statements were created to have a place where values could live. Because other than that, they're out there in the world. They're out there in the what you might call the semiosphere. They're out there in the kind of ether somewhere. And then you try and tie them down with words. Now, from that, you can get data sets, you can create questions, you can generate a whole bunch of analytics to explain, you know, World Values Survey can tell you what people are feeling and thinking at any given time. But come back to the stomach, come back to what you feel. Because in the context of organizational change, in the context of overarching societal purpose, to get a grip with values really means knowing when something is real in your own body. If you can't experience it at that level, then the chances are you haven't actually really said anything. So one way to think about this is maybe it's not a gap at all. Maybe it's a tangle. The problem with the gap metaphor is that you're, you know, when I think of a gap, I think of trying to fix a bit of furniture, or I think of, you know, a clamp trying to get something together again. There is a gap, but I would think it's much more productive to think of it as a more complex relationship. So there's three ways of thinking of that. One is where the values are held. So a friend of mine called Indy Johar speaks about dark matter. And I think a lot of values are held in the dark matter. But by that I mean they're in things like the appraisal structure. They're in things like the organizational structure. They're in things like the way you take, you know, the time you take vacations and how you set that aside for your staff. Because all of these things, the kind of how you get accounted, you know, how your auditing is done, all of these things will create certain implicit expectations and habits and practices through which the values begin to manifest. And those are the things that matter. That's where the values are held. It's not so much in the statement, but in the dark matter of the organization. The second thing to say is that values are only really interesting when they start to clash. You know, ultimately, when people, the reason that people are a bit suspicious of values, especially in a corporate context, is that they think ultimately there's only one bottom line. So people speak about the double bottom line, triple bottom line, and so forth, that it's not just about profit, but also sustainability and social engagement or whatever it is at the time. People are a bit wary of that because when they clash, you know, ultimately, how do you reconcile them? Usually you have to sort of pin down to a final line. And I think the challenge there with incommensurability is that, you know, you can say, you can compare a good orange and a good apple, right? But there's no way of actually saying which is better. What you really want to do is get a value reference point that actually speaks to something that everyone can agree with. And it's an open question if you can actually do that. So one of the first things to say about trying to overcome the values gap is, what kind of agreement do we want? Because you're not going to get agreement on what the right values are. You're not going to get agreement on these are the values we should have. It's really about how do we get constructive tension here? How do we get the optimal conflict that we need so that the values that we hold them more or less consciously, more or less convivially? And the final thing to say is just that values change is difficult because it usually occurs in the complex of other systemic effects which are hidden from view. So think deeply about the root metaphors you have when you're trying to speak of the values gap. What is the underlying system or phenomena that the values live in? So I would say my sort of main contribution today is to say, don't so much ask what are the values or how do we change them or how do we bring them forth. Ask where are they? Where are they and how do we find them and bring them to the surface so that we can speak of them more intelligently?
Jonathan, can I just ask a question before we bring James into the conversation, which is, you're a philosopher, or you have a philosophical background. Philosophy doesn't really help us in a way in terms of being able to determine what is the right thing to do, does it? I mean, you know, anyone who's ever had a kind of debate between utilitarian versus absolute or kind of values will know that, you know, this is a debate that can go on all night and it won't be resolved. So I guess what I'm getting from what you're saying is that the insight that philosophy offers is this need for pluralism, this need for the recognition of multiple dimensions, rather than the hope that, but if you think about it hard enough, you will reach an absolute position.
Yeah, I think ultimately, if you want to get a position with values where actually you understand what you disagree about and why, and that's a big achievement.
So it's almost a discursive notion.
Yeah, it's living and breathing and ongoing. It's not an end point. It has to be something that you live and breathe and constantly reflect on.
Great, thank you very much. James Talbot is Head of Employee Insight at HSBC and researches the behaviour, concerns and aspirations over 250,000 employees. I think you're going to share some data with us.
But a couple of thoughts as well. I was interested, Jonathan, thank you. I've been fearsomely scribbling notes during your 5 minutes. Gap is a word that implies two poles with space in between, I guess, if we're taking away the fact that it could be a mess and it is a gap. And that also implies that you can measure that gap. And if I have any part to play here on the panel, I'm here as the measurement guy. I'm here as the person that spends his time trying to measure these things. And I'm also part of an industry that comes under incredibly regulatory scrutiny to have a view on the measurement of culture or values or the gap in between the two. And I would love to go into my next regulatory meeting and say, it's in my stomach. Just measure the size of my stomach and you'll know the strength of my values. But sadly, it's not quite so possible. But it does mean that I spend my professional career trying to take something that is very abstract, values or culture, and trying to define them. And you said it, you can say almost anything you want about values. That sadly doesn't cut it when you're sat in front of a regulator. So some of the things that we try to do as an industry, that we're trying to do at HSBC, if it will be of interest, I'll just go into them into a small amount of detail. So if you have values and you have a culture, you need to give those things form if you seek to want to define them and you want to measure them. And the way that organisations generally tend to do that is through the expression of those values. You will have large words on a bigger plexiglass in your hall, but everyone has values. Enron had values. Everyone has the same values to a certain extent. Whenever Sainsbury says our values make us different, I always think, well, they don't. They're the same as everyone else's. So it's about how you actually choose to express those values, and that's what employees can react to. That's what gets the reaction from employees, and that's the thing you can get your arms around and try to measure in some way. At HSBC, we have a three-pronged approach to trying to get at whether we are living our values or not, what our culture is. We look at attitude, we look at behaviour, and we look at outcome. So the three different things that employees can do, they can think something, they can feel something, they can behave in a particular way, and possibly a combination of those two things can drive a particular outcome. And what we've learnt as an organisation, and possibly the most important thing we've learnt, is the need for organisations to hold a mirror up to themselves. Traditionally, large organisations, small organisations, the general approach has been on fixing people. If there's a values gap, it's people's fault. They're not living up to the values. They're not behaving in the right way. They're not showing the right behaviours. But all of the evidence that we have through our research at HSBC suggests that actually what plays much more of a role in the behaviour of employees is the environment in which they behave. The way that the organisation is living up to the expression of the values as well as the individuals. No one joins a company to do wrong. Well, very few people join a company to do outright wrong. And the ones that are frequently weeded out. Everyone joins a company to do good things, to serve customers, to provide money to shareholders, to provide money for themselves and their family. No one goes into a job to do a bad thing, or very, very few people. But when they go into an environment where the policies or the process or the systems don't support the behaviours and the values that the organisation espouses, that's where you get the problem and that's where you get some of the gap. And again, the traditional approach, get everyone into a room, teach them some really good tactics, some really good ways to live the values, is fantastic. And you get a room full of people who are really engaged and really excited, who then walk out of that room into an organisation that doesn't support all of the stuff they've just learnt. And you have to wonder why they don't behave in the way 1 week, 1 month, 1 year later. So it's the environmental policies and processes that are the issues. So if there is a gap, it's about organisations looking at themselves and looking at the systematic issues they have, not the unconscious biases, not the thoughts and the feelings, actually what's systematically wrong with the organisation, and fixing those very dry, very mechanistic things. Because actually that has a very big impact on the feelings and the behaviours of individuals with regards to the values.
Thank you, John.
James, do you think that kind of ironically perhaps that one of the challenges here is commercial companies not being afraid to admit that they actually in the end have to make a profit? I mean, I say this because I did a talk a couple of years ago to a utility company. I think its mission statement was something like, we want to delight our customers all the time. So I kind of said, well, why don't you just give them free... just give them free. I mean, why do you charge them at all? They'd be absolutely over the moon. So obviously their actual mission is to make their customers as happy as possible, given that we have to make a profit and we've got shareholders. So it's part of this that there's a kind of peculiar unwillingness to recognise that if you're in a commercial outfit, you are in the business of trying to do as much good as you can, given the realistic constraints of competition and profitability.
I think that whenever you look at an overall outcome, that should be a good. I mean, societal good, for example, with banks. We build infrastructure. We get people's mortgages so they have a secure financial lifestyle for their families. It's about what gets people to that outcome. And so any organisation, certainly any large organisation, will have people sitting in a room somewhere making policy that impacts the customer or impacts people who just deal with the customer. And it's about the distance. It's about the disparity between the people taking the decision and the people being affected by the decision. And then if you can't get those two groups close together, it's about the transparency with which those decisions and that process is explained, or it's about the who you have in mind. So if everyone in the organisation is thinking about the customer, it doesn't matter whether a policy or a process is necessarily not ideal for the customer. If all of the contingent stakeholder groups have been thought about when the decision was being taken, and better yet, you're then transparent about the reasons for that decision, I think you can have both.
Great. Great. Thank you very much. Well, we're going to stay on the subject of banks. So James is talking about what you can do within an organisation to focus on values. There's also a role that can be played by organisations outside the individual bank, but in the sector. So Alison Cottrell is CEO of the Banking Standards Board, which is an organisation which is there to help raise standards of behaviour and competence across the UK banking sector. How's it going, Alison?
We like a challenge. Thank you, Matthew. And just thinking of the, you know, we've heard a little bit here about the gap concept. And I'd agree with that it can be a bit of a distraction, because certainly when we're looking at banks and values, you know, I often think, well, one of the easiest ways to close the gap is you could just change the values, you know, but that's not quite what we're talking about. And also, there can become very much a focus on getting that alignment, but actually it's what the values are that matters. You can get very bad organisations that have no gap between values and the way that people see business being done, but actually you might not want that sort of organisation to be your bank. One of the things that we have been doing in the work at the Banking Standards Board is a survey and a sort of focus groups interviews to look at the culture within individual banks. And within that survey, one of the questions that we ask, and actually accurately it's a statement that respondents agree or disagree with to different extents, is there no tension, not gap, but no tension, between my organisation's stated values and the way that my organisation, my bank or building society that I work for, does business? Do you agree or do you disagree? Now, what we find, and this is on average across all the respondents across the banks and building societies that took part, that's over 28,000 people, about almost two-thirds of them don't see a tension. But 14% did see a tension, or a discrepancy, or a gap, whatever we want to call it. And about one in five actually said, you know, we can't actually say. I won't say yes, I won't say no. Now, given this is an average, for some firms that's smaller, for some firms it's bigger, you know, there is a discrepancy, a tension, whatever we want to call it, out there. And coming back to the points that I made earlier, no, this isn't just about the code. You know, you don't create virtues by codifying them, and people don't suddenly behave in a certain way because you put the words in the lobby. So what can we say about how those things get lived, about how they're in the culture? And just two or three thoughts that have come through in terms of the work we've done and that we're continuing to do to try to dig into some of this. The first thing, we've heard about purpose already, the clarity of the purpose. You know, as Matthew said, what are you here for? It's one of the first questions that we ask the board of a firm when we go and talk to them about this assessment, as part of this assessment process that I mentioned. What are you here for? If an organisation is not clear about why it exists, how is it going to be able to communicate the sort of values the way it expects its people to behave? Secondly, clarity of expectation about the way that things are done. And the way that things are done has to align with that purpose. And actually, stated values, explicit values, as we've heard, you can't get away with having values. They're either implicit in the way people behave and or they're explicit in terms of stated. Why those values? When you look at firms' values, as James has said, there is a lot of overlap between them. You know, there's work that I've seen that many of you may have seen looking at the values across FTSE 100 companies, across Fortune companies. Many of them have, you know, start with integrity, they've got teamwork, they've got excellence, they've got respect. A lot of those words are the same. But actually, values are inclusionary, they are consensual, they're also exclusionary. You know, you want values that say people join this firm because they believe in those values, because those values are priorities. And if you don't agree with them, maybe you shouldn't join that firm. Or maybe you don't stay with that firm. So to actually have teeth to actually mean something, those values are as much about who doesn't join, who doesn't stay, as who stays and who's in it. And do people actually understand those values? That isn't the same as being able to recite them. I've worked with a number of banks over the past year, and the BSB is in its infancy, by the way. We are learning as we go along, so this is simply on the basis of our first year's work, where you could see staff who actually they couldn't remember all the values, and some firms have a lot of values, but from everything they said, you could tell that they actually lived them. They did embody them. So clarity of purpose, clarity of expectation, and thirdly, very importantly, alignment, clear alignment. And this is both in terms of the rules and the processes. So it's pointless to have these are my values, but all my remuneration structures really reward something else. You know, it's clear what wins in that situation. But also the clarity of the culture. and the values. And the culture is those unspoken things about the way that things get done, about the things that make people feel ashamed, that give them status, that make them feel proud. And if you have a tension between the culture and the values, culture wins every single time. So is the culture aligned with the values and the purpose and the rules? This is a lot of stuff to align, but managing a bank and managing any organisation, because none of this is bank specific, is not easy. It's messy. It's hard. And that's life. So is the culture aligned with the values, with the purpose? And then finally, the evidence. When you sit at the top of an organisation and you look down, it always looks rosier than it actually is. And where a member of staff or an employee thinks the CEO or someone senior is not living the values and they bump into them in the lift, they're not going to volunteer that information. So it is the responsibility of everyone who is running an organisation, however small, however big, to actually go out and ask. It is not enough to say, I am listening, you have to go and ask, because you have to give permission to people to tell you if they see a tension, a gap, whatever we want to call it, between the values of the organisation and the way that business is being seen to be done. And for the board, for the senior executive team, if that culture is not what they think it is, then whatever they're saying in terms of strategy, objectives, planning, whatever, it is going to be delivered in a different way. Because the culture and the values and the way that employees see and behave will affect the way they respond to incentives and everything else. So I would say the main thing that makes sure the values are lived, the key thing is for the people that run the organisation to keep asking the question and then to listen to the responses that come back.
Just on that final point, I mean, it's very hard, I would imagine, to empower people to speak honestly to you. And one of the issues has come up a bit recently in banks and in the past, as well as around kind of whistleblowing. So I'm just interested, what kind of have you seen in terms of good practice, in terms of really enabling people at the front line to be able to... I mean, I remember talking to people before the crash who were... really strongly incentivized to sell products to people that they shouldn't have sold them to, and the misery they felt really day in, day out in doing that. So what is the best practice in terms of really enabling people in an organization to be able to say, I'm not happy about this, without feeling that they're going to be, it's kind of career suicide?
Yeah, and I think there are a number of things. I mean, you need to have different routes, because if there is any one person to go and talk to, I'm not talking here about formal whistleblowing, we're talking sort of before you get to that point. How do you just challenge and say this doesn't feel right or this isn't the most effective way of doing it? It comes back to that cultural issue there, because you need to have the ability of people to talk upwards in the line management chain and across with peers about this. You know, do other people feel the same way? Because if you only have one point or one person to go to and that person doesn't listen, then where do you go? And generally people will then go with the norm or then use their powers of exit and just leave the firm or whatever if they don't like it. But you need to encourage that culture of speaking up and listening and acting on it. And it's interesting, there was some research, and I wish I could remember who'd done this now, but it was looking at contrasting the US and the UK in terms of why people didn't speak up and the reasons that they gave. And this is actually one of the things that we're testing and digging into a little bit more in this year's exercise at the Banking Standards Board. But when they looked at the work that had been done in the US, they found the main reason for not speaking up and challenge was because people were concerned about the consequences of their career. And there was the fear factor. When they looked in the UK...
Is it just embarrassment in the UK? Is that what you're going to
in
say?
The UK, no, it was close. That was very English, right. But it was close. It was more inertia. If I talk up, nothing's going to be done anyway, so why bother? Now, if you're spending your time as an organisation trying to fix the whistleblowing line, the confidentiality, but the reason people aren't saying anything is because nothing ever happens, you know, that's not going to change anything. So how do you get that culture where people speak up and something is done, it is worth their while, and no, it doesn't damage their career? And there's something to be said here for leading by example at the top. You know, if you have situations where your senior people are willing to say, yeah, I made a mistake there, and this is what we learnt from it, or I disagree with this or whatever, then it gives people permission, but you have to keep giving people permission.
Very good, thank you for that. We had a bit of a problem at the RSA because The one channel we had for not living up to our values was Jonathan, because he used to come to every staff meeting and put his hand up at the beginning and say, why aren't we living up to our values? So once he left, of course, we were... So you shouldn't be over-dependent on one whistleblower. That's the lesson of that. Now, so we talked about banks, who aren't necessarily the most popular of organisations or considered to be the most ethical, but now let's turn finally to an organisation which everyone seems to be incredibly warm about. So Jeff McDonald is a former global VP of HR at Unilever. So he's former, but... part of that company, and no doubt it's very kind of powerful brand as an ethical company. So Jeff has spent much of his career trying to embed purpose and well-being at the heart of a huge multinational organisation, not without success. So Jeff, share your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Matthew. Two schoolboy errors. Two of them. One is agreeing to go last on the panel, because all that I wanted to say has been said. And I'm not sure what the second one is, but it'll come to me just now. So I kind of agree with a lot of what has been said on the panel today. I mean, it's really important to have this concept of purpose. We've really got to build all this stuff into the infrastructure of organizations. We've got to have the right kind of environment. Yet, since leaving Unilever over the last couple of years, I've been spending a huge amount of time trying to get organizations to really, really think about this concept of purpose and live it. Not just have it as some wonderful statement, which I now call purpose washing. There's so much purpose washing that's going on out there right now, where everybody's got these lovely purpose statements, which are all about enhancing the reputation of the organization and maybe attracting some millennials, because millennials are looking for purpose. All right? So they just go down this route of what I call purpose washing. And let me just share with you, I think, because I agree with what everybody has said on the panel in terms of, you know, values in pursuit of what? In pursuit of what? And that's why I think this concept of purpose becomes so important. And then we have to begin to, I think, shift our mindsets around what is the purpose of business. And Matthew was saying, well, it's kind of, or alluded to, the purpose is to make money. Well, I would say that that's the consequence of doing good business. It's not the purpose of business. It's the consequence. And it's a little bit like, in order for me to live every single day, what have I got to do? What have I got to do? I've got to breathe. I've got to breathe. But I don't live to breathe. I live to do something else. And it's the same, I think, with organizations. I think we've got to find a way, and the system's not helping, where organizations and CEOs have got the courage to think beyond growth and profitability. And people will say, well, tell me, you know, in Unilever, of course, Unilever quarterly results, but guess what? There was a courageous leader there who went to the market and said, no more guidance. He said, no more guidance. No more guidance. He had courage to go to the market and say, no more guidance. And so I think we've got one, I think we need more courage. We need more courageous leaders in organizations today to kind of say, enough is enough. The old system is not working. We have to find a way of ensuring that all stakeholders share in the value of the organization. The second thing is, I think what I'm seeing is organizations trying to answer the question, why do we exist? It's not about why we exist. I think it's about why we do what we do. Because the only way you can live your purpose authentically is by doing what you do. So the only way Unilever can live its purpose is by selling more brands. Selling more Lifebuoy, selling more Dove, selling more Surf, so that it can enhance the health and the well-being and improve the environment, etc., etc. So it's about why do we do what we do. Finally, what I would say is that what I see is these wonderful purpose statements, so like the one that Matthew described, which was about delighting our customers. Well, what does that mean? What does it actually mean? How do you measure it? How do you set some goals in place to see whether you actually are performing and you are living that sense of purpose? They're lovely purpose statements, but then when I ask people, what does it actually mean? Tell me, what are the goals? What are the measures? How are you going to know? How are you going to hold one another accountable as to whether you're living that purpose? Well, nobody can answer that question for me. Nobody can answer that question. And then finally, I think what James was saying is absolutely true. This requires a significant transformation of an organization. This is not about just leaders going off and finding their own purpose and getting all hunky-dory and happy about it and then going out into the organization and finding that all the systems and the policies and the processes work against everything that they want to do. This requires significant, hard graft, and it doesn't happen overnight. And in Unilever's case, they continue on this journey, 10 years into the transformation of that organization. 10 years. And there aren't too many CEOs who hang around that long. Thank you.
Jeff, can I just ask, where do you think the boundaries are to the responsibility of a corporation? So, you know, we've had the kind of concept of shared value. There's a responsibility for supply chains, for employees, for the relationship with the community. Where do you... I mean, there must come a point where it feels like you can't take responsibility for everything in the world. That kind of question of where is your kind of footprint, how do you think corporations need to respond to that?
Yeah, Matthew, I do think it is about, and I don't know where the boundary is absolutely, but I do think as an organization, we've got to move beyond saying that the only reason we exist is to create value for our shareholder. I think it has to go beyond the shareholder. I think it has to go the communities in which we operate in. And for all organizations, it might be a little bit different, but what are the communities that I operate in? The consumer or my customer, they are a stakeholder of my business, and we've got to meet their needs as well. I've also got to look after my suppliers in the supply chain. None of these issues, you know, trying to be a more purpose-led organization, it's so difficult to do because you can't do it on your own. You need a kind of cross and a collaborative approach to this. And so, therefore, charities, academia, cross-sector collaboration, which brings kind of systems thinking and a new way of doing things. So I think you've got to identify, who are those key... So, for example, in Unilever's case, you know, we could have gone and supported every single charity in the world. No ways. We can't do that. We had to choose 4 or 5 that were truly going to help us to live our purpose and then really partner with those. So, yes, we had to tell the blind school in North America, we're not going to give you any more money. Why? Because that didn't help us sell one more bar of soap. Not one more bar of soap. So I think it's about trying to identify beyond the shareholder those critical stakeholders that are absolutely critical in helping you to live your purpose and at the same time deliver growth and profitability for your organization.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm interested in the notion of enlightened self-interest in this debate. So, you know, one of the things that one comes up again and again, is the notion that, well, you know, the reason you should live up to your values, you should close the values gap or untangle the values knot or whatever it might be, is because ultimately... It is in the interests of you as an organisation. You'll be more profitable, more productive, you'll happier workers, you'll recruit these irritating millennials who insist on everything. But on the other hand, it's a slightly problematic idea, because what if it isn't in your self-interest? Does that mean that you don't do it anymore? So I'm interested in your work. Do you articulate an idea of enlightened self-interest, and do you think that helps us?
We don't articulate it in that sense, but I can see what you're getting at. If there is that sense where the circle doesn't join up, then have you got the right values? Have you got the right purpose to start with? I mean, there are clear responsibilities and values as an employer, I think. You know, there is the purpose of the organisation in the sector it's in and in the market it's in. And then there are the responsibilities to staff and to the people that work with it and to broader society.
Is that where regulation needs to come in when there isn't really an enlightened self-interest case, where people are going to have to be required to do it?
I think regulation will depend on the actual situation of the market and the sector.
Right.
But what we're talking about here is stuff beyond regulation. I mean, what we're talking about here is actually what good looks like. You know, the regulation kicks in where you need things for consumer protection, asymmetries of information, all of these things, and they're actually what is the minimum level that needs to be reached or what is it that needs to be prohibited. But do we really want to live in a world where anything that's not prohibited or not mandated by regulation is fair game? You know, which then brings you into, okay, what is the culture? What are the values of the firms in this sphere? And perhaps some of this tension comes down to timescales, because often what we talk about when we say, look, you know, it's in the good of the employees, it's in the good of the business, we mean it's in the good of the business over the long term.
Right.
And that's where the role of investors comes in. When we're talking about PLCs, not mutuals, obviously, that's a different model. But do you have then short-term horizons? And that's when it comes back to the profit move and the, you know, in the share price and things. And that's where I think you get that balancing act. And coming back to the point that that's where you need the really strong leadership to be able to say, actually, this is what we're here for, this is what we're doing, this is what works over the longer term, and the board and the CEO need to be fully aligned on this.
James, just your take on this kind of enlightened self. I mean, when you're making the argument within HSBC for what needs to be done, do you articulate it to senior executives through a notion of enlightened self-interest, or do you just say, no, actually, this is just what we need to do?
It's an interesting point. I mean, just framing it back to the overall values and the fact that all values are the same. I mean, you'd imagine that because you wouldn't expect to have too many organisations that would have values that weren't in their self-interest. And seeing as most organisations have a purpose that is meant to be contributing to society in some way, that's generally going to be a positive thing. I mean, values are twins, just as sustainability is, as Jeff was saying, to strategy. So you have strategy and things can come from there. In terms of how we recommend stuff to the board within HSBC or kind of the findings we have, it helps that it's all grounded in data. So it's relatively objective, certainly when you're looking at behavioural stuff rather than attitude and sentiment. And it is largely framed in terms of the fact that if you say these are our values, if you say that this is the way that we should work, we have something in HSBC called the Charter, which looks at all the different stakeholder groups that could be affected by a decision and whether you've looked at them, whether you have them in mind when you're taking decisions. So if you're walking that talk, to use a hackneyed and awful phrase, and apologies for using it, then this just becomes one more part and parcel of your decision-making process. You have stuff about your customers, stuff about your shareholders, stuff about society, and stuff about your employees. I mean, the role that I play at HSBC is to bring employees into every single room and every single decision that's being taken. Because quite often, particularly if you have a pattern of employee insight that's annual or biannual, you have a very large gap in terms of actually understanding what your employees are thinking. Whereas at HSBC, we don't. We have a very continuous discussion with our employees, and so we always know what's on their minds, and we can always put that into the conversation, into the debate when a decision has to be taken.
Great. Jeff, enlightened self-interest?
Yeah, no, Matthew, it's all about. That's what it's all about. I mean, and I know this is being filmed, so if you don't like what I'm saying, but I know that he has said it. I mean, the reason that Unilever has gone down this whole route was to improve its performance. I mean, it was performing so badly back in 2009. The vultures were going to take it on. They were going to split it up and all the rest. And the only way in which he felt that we could improve the performance of that organization was to give people a sense of pride and ambition. And that's what purpose did. So it is about enlightened self-interest. It's about ensuring that that organization survives and continues for now into infinity. But do good at the same time. Do good at the same time. So do well by doing good.
So, Jonathan, I'm interested. What do you think of enlightened self-interest? As it's nice to think that all things line up together, but is it problematic because it leaves us adrift when they don't?
I think it's problematic because it depends entirely on the notion of the self and on how enlightened it is. Really, I mean, it comes down to that. So, one way of looking at this is, I'll come back to the big thing, but to come back to a simple problem, like an employee may be very talented, but they don't really feel like speaking up, or they may have a very acute critique of what's happening, but they won't say anything because of the incentives we mentioned earlier. Now, that's at the problem level, okay? And we often deal with problems just specifically, like, you go to them and say, maybe next time speak up. And there's a more complex level still, which is the policy level, which is, okay, we'll change the policy so that we incentivize people to speak up. So when they have the appraisal, we'll notice how often they've done that and factor that in. But further to that is the kind of systemic level, which is, you're changing things in the sort of DNA of the organization. But really, what matters is the level beyond that. And to be honest, the reason I created Perspectiva was because I think that's the level we have to get to. It's the level of the paradigm or the imaginary that goes beyond the system, the level where the cultures and the feelings meet the system. So in this context, enlightened self-interest, well, if yourself is the ego who wants to get the status from the world, then it's a problem. If the self is that, but it's also this expansive notion of someone who evolves through life, maybe grows in virtue somehow, gets to the point where they integrate their self and also begin to transcend it, then you're actually getting somewhere. And if your notion of enlightened self-interest is that you deal with not just your own self-interest, your organizational interest, but also somehow look after the planet and make sure that the communities you work with are well treated, that's good up to a point. But if you think it really through, if you're really tenacious in your inquiry, you have to at least be open to the idea that it may not work, that it may be that perpetual consumption, indefinite growth, We might make the best of a bad hand, but that hand might be utterly rotten. So you just have to be open to, you know, what it means to do well within the constraints of the imaginary and what it means to actually change the imaginary.
Thank you, Jonathan. Okay, so we're going to accelerate now because I'm absolutely certain there will be lots of people who've got points. I'm going to ask you to make your point as quickly as you can, and what we'll do is we'll take four or five comments. Tell us your name and be brief. Thank you.
Jeremy Kaplan, I'm a fellow here. Very briefly, I'd just like to take a word that James said, see if there's another way of looking at it. I'm not sure it's mirror. I think it might be lens. Because the key question is, who are you willing to be judged by? And so from a point of view of a company, it's not only internally, but it's also your suppliers, it's your customers, and it's that idea. I mean, one of the things you've got to say about Paul Polman, I worked with him many years ago at Procter, and he's been the same all the way through. He will stand out there and say things consistently and clearly and be willing to be judged on them. So I think it's about opening it up and saying, who am I willing to be embarrassed by or embarrassed in front of, get naked in front of?
Okay, getting naked. I'm glad that's come up. Yep, right there.
Thanks. I'm Roger Cow. I've written about corporate responsibility for a long time. It seems to me the one thing that's missing in what everyone said is the question of commercial pressure, financial pressure, because it's fine. It's easy to live your values when things are going fine. But, you know, whether you think about individual traders on in a banking floor that cheat the system because they're under pressure to deliver returns or they're under personal pressure to a big bonus, or the Tesco executives who fiddle the figures because they were under lots of pressure, commercial pressure, or indeed Unilever, who suddenly decided after Kraft came calling that they needed to do a few things that they weren't going to do otherwise. And it comes back to your analogy about breathing, Jeff. You know, when breathing's easy, you can concentrate on lots of other things, but if your breathing's threatened, then that's the only thing you can really concentrate on.
Great, thank you. And then back there.
Hello, Angela Harvey, a fellow here. I'd like to get some comment on the public sector. People join because they want to do good, but the experience within and certainly the service to those without, there's a bit of a gap.
Right. Okay, that's good. It could be an event all on its own, but we'll try and cover that. Yep.
Timothy Henry from Conscious Capitalism, so we'll resonate with a lot of this with what we're doing. When you talk about enlightened self-interest, on the one hand, there's incredible evidence that says high engagement, high trust, high caring cultures all have higher performance. There's tremendous data that shows the long-term perspective related to those things drive higher performance. So in that sense, the data speaks for itself, and yet we have this narrative about business that seems to ignore the facts, ignores the fact that there's tremendous evidence around this, around what drives high performance. So I'm curious, why is the discussion from your point of view at the board level not occurring, that the boards themselves are looking at this and saying, we have the wrong narrative, we have the wrong story we tell about business, because this is clearly a better way of doing business, but we're not performing that way and we're not acting that way.
Great, thank you. And then there's a hand right at the back there.
Thank you. It's Ali Carsby. I'm a fellow. Just a quick question to the panel, which is any advice for Theresa May as to how to close the British values gap?
That's like the kind of joke question at the end of question time, isn't it? But you've introduced it slightly early, so I'll leave the panel to decide how to respond to that. Okay, so panel, pick just one of those points, if you don't. I know it's hard because they're all really interesting questions, but starting with you, Jeff, just choose one of those things to respond to so we can bring another group of people
in. I am going to sound defensive. I mean, yes, 3G's come, but that hasn't led Unilever to engage in unethical behaviour. No, but you compared Unilever to a Tesco and to the banks and all this sort of stuff. So I don't think it's led Unilever to believe the system is forcing Unilever. Some shareholder out there wants a 25% return, not a 16% return. And so Unilever's having to look to see how they can do that. Yeah.
Okay. Jen?
I'd like to take the point about public sector. I think it's an interesting one. I think, again, what you're seeing is the result of unintended effects of policies and procedures and structures. Good people join the public sector. Good people join every company. But they are stymied by either the collective inertia of an organisation or just something that's been badly written that means they can't do what they want to do.
But isn't it also hierarchy itself? I mean,
yes.
You know, isn't one of the really big challenges in this that hierarchy
it seems to me, and you know, Weber wrote about this brilliantly, you know, over 100 years ago, kind of hierarchy itself, bureaucracy, strips out people's capacity for kind of moral judgment and ethical judgment within organisations.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have too strong a sense of hierarchy, if you have too strong a sense of rules, policies and guidelines maybe coming in front of relationships with people, then you have an organisation where people are very happy to escalate, very happy to remove their own personal accountability for doing their jobs or doing something that comes across their desk, because they can just send it to the person above them and they'll copy their manager or they'll copy their manager's manager. And that will happen in actually lots of the large commercial organisations as well as the public sector. But that's what it is that sense of, do I value you for what you have achieved, or do I value you because you have a fancy title or you are a grade above me in the organisational hierarchy? And if you have that, and if you have, and again, that's very driven by environment, if you have that kind of environment, then people over time will shift their behaviours to suit. Personal behaviour trends towards organisational norms every time.
So the point that Weber made was that there's in organisations there's a clash between substantive rationality, which is rationality about ends, and procedural rationality, which is rationality about rules. And what he said was that bureaucracies have an inherent tendency over time to privilege procedural rationality over substantive rationality, which is why it is there's a kind of constant tension there. I think it's one of the most powerful ideas in social science. Alison.
Yeah. This point on the mirror, the lens, and who judged by and who judges. Speaking from our own experience, one of the challenges for firms is actually creating that space to be self-critical and then having the evidence to be able to judge themselves by, and then to be able to talk about this with their staff, with their investors, with their regulators, with whoever else, with broader society as appropriate. And it's creating that space, and here we're talking about, yes, the senior executive team, but also the non-execs, the board, you know, the people from outside who are brought in to challenge to actually how can they ask the right questions, and how do they have the information to help them shape those questions and have those questions answered. And one of the things that we're doing with this assessment work that I mentioned, because this actually puts a picture back to the bank, both of this is what different parts of your organisation look like, this is what your staff, what your employees are telling us, and by the way, this is how you look relative to all of the other firms that are doing this exercise as well. Having actually the willingness, the bravery perhaps even, to ask this question, say, OK, this is how we're doing, but you know, we thought we were doing well, but we're way behind all the other firms in this sector. That's a very difficult conversation for some boards to have. But would you rather have a firm that was asking those questions, even if the answers weren't comfortable for the firm, or would you have a firm that wasn't? And actually it's creating that space in the first instance for the board to have that discussion and be critical of itself. And by the way, to work out what it's doing really well, so it knows what to prioritise. And it comes back to the evidence point. You know, this has to be as hardwired in the firm as all of the financials, as all of the other investment projects, because this is investment in what really matters to the firm. And when the going gets tough, going back to this point about what happens when the pressure comes on, this has to stick. If the culture bit is just bolted on, then absolutely it falls away as soon as the pressure comes on. But if you can somehow measure the outcomes and the effects of what it's doing, then maybe it stays in there.
Thank you. Jonathan.
I'm going to take the gauntlet on the British values gap question. So I think the quick answer is that it's beyond Theresa May or any other individual to resolve it. But the reason it's very interesting, it taps into some of the other things we've spoken about, particularly timescales. So what you have in the UK at the moment is we're awash with intransitive preferences. Lots of people want things they can't possibly get at the same time. There's lots of cues about what people want that actually pack into one decision multiple preferences that aren't always commensurate. And that's sort of, you know, discordant with other preferences that are in play that are then sort of sidelined, and we're told that one is the will and one isn't the will. So we're currently in a state of play where we really don't know what the country as a whole thinks in any coherent, singular way. All we have is a huge amount of discordant voices and noises. Now, what do you do when that happens, right? That happens in organizations, it happens in families, it happens all the time. One of the things you do is you take some time to talk together, right? But the challenge is with timescales, and this happens on question time, it's going to happen today. It happens particularly in organizations, in my experience, where you're beginning to get somewhere. You're talking, beginning to feel, something's happening here. We're beginning to get to the nub of this. And then I say, okay, we'll meet again 2 weeks' time, okay? And the feeling collapses. Everything sort of goes. So in the same way with the UK as a whole, I think, you know, this so-called national conversation we hear about all the time, we've never done it very well. But I think the only answer to where we are now is a very well-structured, very carefully done national conversation so that we have a chance to get beyond the discourse and the noises and begin to actually feel together what's going on and what we should do next.
Great. Paul Palmarosa, Director of Principal Business. I'd like to go back to that point because what's happened in business is it's short-term quantifiable results. And when you look at values, many company values, you ask them, what are they? Well, it's efficiency, it's productivity. But what about the core values behind them? Because a business is a human activity. What about truth? What about justice? What about courage? What about these? Those are natural values for everyone. And that's where, and many of the philosophers will tell you, these values, live those, and the profits will come. And that's what I...
Great, thank you. And then immediately behind you. Thank you.
I will be extra quick. Really appreciate who's on the board, and please don't take this comment as criticism for you. But why does the financial sector, particularly the wealth fund managers, the fund managers, are completely incompetent and unaware that the values of their clients, the irritating next generation millennials, their values will become embedded on how they manage their finances? And just from my experience with a lot of fund managers, they just cannot accept that the opinions of millennials will affect their services, and they're just sticking their head in the sand.
Okay, thank you. And then here?
I've just got a simple question, which is, if corporations didn't have shareholders, how would their values change? And if they would change, why aren't they not working towards that systemic change?
I would just say, I think 6 of the largest 10 companies in America now are privately owned, so we kind of know. And it's not great. Yeah.
So I've got 3 from Twitter.
Choose one.
The final one, then, because it's quite a good one to end on, is there a global movement to make changes happen around values? If not, should there be?
Okay, thank you. And then, yeah, the giant guy there, yep.
I was involved with Barclays during LIBOR and beyond into setting up the values and setting up how we would redo rewards and so on after that. So I've got pretty hands-on experience. Two thoughts. One is, I think unless you change that system, not a lot will change, and I don't think enough happened to change it. But it's not something that one agent within the industry can change. It needs industry-wide change, and not just in the UK, so there's a limit to even what the BSB can do to influence that. The second comment would be about values and picking the right values from this infinite plethora of values we could pick. I've done some work recently with companies who've had major crises where, when we went into it and looked at root causes, they had followed their values beautifully. But they just have missed something important about whatever it was, respect or something that really had laid them wide open. So I still think we've got a difficult problem of how we pick the right values, given our purpose.
Thanks. Jonathan Tavs, fellow from Los Angeles. It was mentioned that teamwork would be everybody's value. So it's interesting that Uber, that's currently imploding, just added teamwork in 2016. And also what we're finding now is that their purpose seemed to be screwing people over at all odds, and their environment or culture was about having fun at all costs. So going back to the subject line of this, of the description where it talks about BS, are values really BS, and it really is more important for purpose and culture and allowing values to work out however they need to work out?
Great. Thank you. Jeff, I'm afraid you've only got a minute, but feel free to choose any question.
I'm just going to... I just think this thing about purpose, and I think we've got to almost stop talking to CEOs about purpose. And I think we should go in at the point of, you know, if you're struggling to attract talent, if you've got CSR activities that are you're wasting money with and you want to pull them all together, if you want to enhance your reputation as an organization, if you have got a merger and acquisition that's taking place, I think it's those sorts of conversations that then go up to maybe the purpose conversation rather than us starting in and going saying, hey, I think we need a purpose in this organization.
Thank you. James?
I'm going to save time by taking 2 at the same time. So if companies didn't have shareholders in this conversation about deeper values and kind of a sense of things that are ephemeral, HSBC is an organisation that celebrated its 150th birthday the year before last, I think it was. And during that process, we told lots of stories about ourselves through our history. The story that we were a company started by a Scotsman in Hong Kong with Indian seed money, for example, or all of the stuff that we did to write down the debts and say that it was okay for people in the post-World War II occupation to cash in their the notes that were no longer a real currency. those kind of stories and those kind of myths and anecdotes tell of an organisation with extraordinary heritage, an extraordinary sense of its own history and knowledge about itself. And so my own view, and a hope, I'd suggest, rather than a knowledge, is that if we didn't have shareholders, our values wouldn't be any different, because all that we've done over the past 150 years plays to exactly the things that we actually put on our value statement now: dependable, open and connected, and our sense of courageous integrity. I don't think it would change.
Helen?
Yeah, actually, this will address just two or three of the questions that were asked in that round. I mean, I think it always comes down to the fact for me that the culture trumps everything else at the end of the day. So the culture will beat the values that are in the lobby, will beat the rules, will beat whatever. What affects culture? Yes, it's the leadership, absolutely. It's also the composition of the group that we're talking about. And while, you know, while my work is with banks, actually 90% of what I do could be any organisation. It's about sets of people in organisations. And if you have an organisation which is made of, and I'm sort of exaggerating here for effect, you know, 20-year-old males, it's going to be different from an organisation which is 65-year-old females. You know, there will be aspects of the culture and the dynamics that are different. And you can change organisations quite quickly by changing composition of individuals. And it will reflect the environment they work in. Part of that is whether they're a shareholder, whether it's long-term, whether it's short-term. So this is a complex thing. It's affected by lots of different angles. And yes, absolutely, it needs more than one agent to change culture in a firm, in a sector, you know, across an economy. And that's going to be the people in the firm, it's going to be the leadership, it's going to be everyone in that firm, it's going to be the customers, customer pressure, it's going to be the investors, and it's going to be all of the external factors around it. This is dynamic. And then it's someone, well, we often hear culture described as a big journey. I once heard someone saying this isn't a journey, it's a treadmill. You know, it never stops. You keep going on it, and it keeps changing.
Jonathan?
The line that struck me most today was when we heard values in service of what. That was the one where I felt, again, coming back to the stomach, where I actually felt something important was being said. And that stays with me. It's like, it's not really about picking values for me. I think no matter which values you pick, if you open yourself up to critique, if you allow yourself to have a devil's advocate in the room, those values will quite quickly come under significant pressure, both in terms of how you act and in terms of other values that will come into conflict with them. So really, you've got to get beyond those values, actually. If it's going to be closing the values gap or untying the values tangle, you've got to have something higher order purpose that isn't about one of many values, but is some overarching story of who human beings are, what we're trying to do together, and how we work together for the greater good with all the constraints that we have. If you don't have that reference point, then your values will be brittle and will ultimately collapse.
Thank you, Jonathan. Well, sadly, that's all we've got time for today. If you want to continue this conversation, and it's been a fantastic hour we've had together, then it is World Values Day on the 19th of October, and the RSA is working with World Values Day and with the Forward Institute to kind of design a kind of one-hour session. It'll be the beginning. You know, I'm very taken by your point about the length of the conversation. But it's a kind of structured hour where people can talk about the values gap or the values tangle or whatever it is we want to talk about. So start that conversation going. So if you're interested in finding out more about that, then I think we've got a kind of beta version of how we're going to use that hour on the World Values Day website, on the Forward Institute website, and the RSA will be talking much more to its fellows about that as well. So please do get involved in that. We'd like to see thousands of conversations in all different types of organisations on the 19th of October about the issues that we've been debating today. So thank you all for joining me. Thank you for your brilliant questions. It just remains for me to ask you to join me in giving a hand to our wonderful panel, Alison, Jeff, Jonathan and James.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.